prosecutor. So he has, both these gentlemen have over 30 years of experience in dealing with violence, passing judgment, assessing risk, trying to decide, make opinions about this phenomenon of violence. Well, Judge Crichton, we were talking off the air about violent behaviors and what your experience is with this, and you were talking about this recipe for violence that you had. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, from what I've seen, and I draw my experience from having been an assistant district attorney here in Caddo Parish for 10 years, and after that, 24 years as a judge, and you know, I've seen a lot. I've had occasion to, you know, make charging decisions as an assistant DA, prosecute cases, ask juries to return verdicts of guilty as charged in violent cases, and then on the judicial side, I've had the opportunity to hear evidence and sentence those that are convicted of violent crimes. And there does seem to be a recipe that leads to a bad result. And so many times it involves the child in the womb, you know, with the mother that is a severe alcoholic or drug abuser. It can also begin with a very poor early environment. Poverty is a key issue, of course. Illiteracy at home is an issue. Absent mother, unavailable mother, either working two jobs to support a household full of kids or on drugs, in any event, unavailable, no dad at home. That's sort of the home life. So family is sort of non-existent. And then we move into elementary school. We have lack of attendance, bad performance, lack of parental teacher communication, behavior problems, bad grades, dropout. Hanging out on the street at early adolescence, no ownership in anything, and no family life, no support, and then you introduce drugs into it, illegal drugs, and then you introduce guns, and you have therefore a very bad recipe. So you have a person who's not equipped to get a job, who cannot get past high school, who is angry but doesn't know why, frustrated. His family is a gang of thugs on the street. He's involved in drug use, perhaps gun use, perhaps both. And, you know, of course, no skills in terms of inability. There's no skills in terms of ability to handle conflict situations and no self-esteem. You know, it is a colossal recipe for a bad result.
Sounds like it's a cascade of a whole lot of factors that are involved in causing violent behavior. Is there any single larger factor? What do you think, Alan, about this?
Having been a public defender for about 25 years and having also been a prosecutor, I have come to realize that no one is immune. By that I mean that everyone is vulnerable to being a victim of a violent crime, and everyone is susceptible to becoming a perpetrator of a violent crime. Violence knows no racial, ethnic, or socioeconomic boundaries. My biggest surprise in doing this work as both a prosecutor and a district public defender was that discovering that people who commit the worst crimes aren't monsters, but most of the time they're ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And what I've also discovered that is that if you want to see the face of crime, look in the mirror, because the person who commits a violent crime looks just like us.
So it could be anyone.
It can be anyone. Although there are certain risk factors or predictors of violent behavior, in other words, certain circumstances in a person's life that make them more susceptible to becoming a violent perpetrator.
Okay. And I'd like to invite our listeners to join our conversation. If you would like to, call in with your questions at 1-800-552-8502. And we were talking about violence. And, of course, violence, there's been quite a number of violent acts that have been perpetuated here lately. It's been all over the news and media. And, of course, in psychology, these kind of acts that we kind of watch out for mimics, people who want to repeat these things because they are getting quite a bit of attention. But our listeners and lots of people are probably concerned about how do we predict this? How do we predict this? How can we stop this kind of stuff? Are there things that we're missing with these individuals? Any thoughts?
Well, I think that we as a community, we have to be alert and on guard and aware of some of the risk factors. It's true, as Alan said, that the world is full of violence and no one is absolutely immune from it. I mean, it can be a bank teller that is shot and killed during a robbery. It can be a Circle K clerk or a Circle K customer. It could be, I had a case several years ago, a lady on outside of a bank waiting for a taxi was hit in the head and teeth knocked out by a guy who tried to rob the bank but was unsuccessful, and while running out decided he would rob her of her purse. He wouldn't let go.
So that's kind of impulsive.
Yeah, well, it's kind of impulsive, and it's extremely violent, of course. It was probably an afterthought by him, I suppose, but caused her severe damage. Or think about this in terms of the mass shootings and murders across the country. You can be sitting in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, or a movie theater in closer to home, Lafayette, Louisiana, or praying at church in Charleston, South Carolina, or at an elementary school at Sandy Hook in Connecticut, or at a military recruitment center in Chattanooga. So, you know, it is all around us. And I do think that there are risk factors if you look at these individuals. But, you know, here's the thing. We know this in hindsight because they commit these terrible acts. And they get into the system, and of course, with some mass murderers, a good many of them kill themselves. About 50%, by the way, of mass murderers commit suicide during the event, much like Rusty Hauser did in Lafayette, and much like Holmes may have planned to do in Colorado. But one writer on the subject of mass murder said it's like a highway in hindsight dotted with signs missed or misinterpreted. So the signs are there, and authorities don't get involved in the private lives of individuals.
Sure.
That we would deem that to be obnoxious government intrusion. But what are the signs? And when you see these rants by someone, for example, like Rusty Hauser, who used social media to rant and rave against abortion, against women working, against the federal government, against African Americans, against all kind of things, and protective orders and all that business in his background. I mean, I would suggest those are some pretty critical signs that were missed.
Well, sure.
Or misinterpreted.
And he has, and I think there's a common thread amongst these individuals. And I'd like to remind our listeners that we're sitting with Louisiana Supreme Court Justice Scott Creighton and the head of the Indigent Defender Board, if I can say that correctly, Alan Golden.
And you did a good job, I think.
Close enough. Close enough. Actually, it's called the District Public Defender Office.
Oh, okay. The District Public Defender's Office, if I stand corrected. But I'd like our listeners to join us and call in, and we're talking about violence and what can we do about it.
And the number is 1-800-552-8502.
But I think, going back to what you were talking about, Your Honor, that there is kind of a common thread amongst all three of those big those larger incidents of violence that we've seen, the Sandy Hook, the Colorado shooting, the one more recent in Lafayette, all of them have had some sort of mental health problem, and I would really hate for people with these types of problems to be stigmatized like that, because there's lots of people out there with emotional and psychological problems that don't commit these kind of crimes.
Well, there's no question about that. There are people that are bipolar who function with medication perfectly well, or almost perfectly well. And it's important if you have a family member too that has a medical issue, a medical illness in particular, one as serious as bipolar. And I don't want to get into your lane of travel. I'm gonna stay in my lane, which is the legal. You stay on the health because you know about that. But you know, for example, this James Holmes guy who did the mass shooting in the Century 16. Theater in Colorado, he had a history of mental illness.
He did.
Not insane, however, but...
Can you explain the difference in that?
Well, the basic difference is you can have all sorts of mental illness and dysfunction. There are lots of people with mental illness and dysfunction, and they are not criminals. They work through it, many of them, and some are on medication, and the medication works, and we never really hear much about all that. But this guy, for example, in Colorado, was dysphoric. He had dysphoric mania, bipolar, which I don't completely understand. You can tell us more about that, I suspect. But the way I've understood it to be frenetic mania plus major depression. But anyway, a serious illness. Not sufficiently treated, obviously, but to answer your question, insanity, in terms of the law, is the inability to know right from wrong, and that is a standard that is sometimes hard to meet. Now, different states have placed the burden on different sides. In some states, the law requires a prosecution to prove that the person is not insane. And then other states put that burden on the defendant to prove that he is insane. Mm-hmm. But irrespective of who has the burden, certainly the issue comes before the judge and the jury. And Alan can speak about that because he's been there, I know. But my point is, whichever side has the burden of proof on that particular issue, it is a high burden to prove that the individual, under the circumstances, did not know right from wrong. Hauser, obviously, in Lafayette, had parked his car nearby, had the keys on the tire. He was ready to make his getaway, and it just didn't work out for him in terms of that getaway thing.
He knew what he was trying to do.
Well, he knew what he was doing, and he planned to get out of there as quickly as he could. And thank God he did not elude police. The whole thing, of course, is a tragedy with two fine people killed and 9 or 10 others injured by gunfire in a theater watching a movie. A romantic comedy, I think.
Trainwreck, I think the movie was.
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, it's certainly had he lived to be prosecuted, a big piece of evidence on the sanity issue would be that he had planned his getaway with disguises and wigs and caps and a car waiting for him right outside the exit door with the keys on one of the tires. So that would have been good evidence for either the state or for whichever side in that case would have to prove it. But anyway, Alan might want to chime in on this issue because I know he's been there.
Sure. The number of cases where we represented defendants who are charged with either first or second degree murder, we very often discovered that they've had longstanding mental health issues. Some of them started actually in the womb, where they had to endure the effects of alcohol, and they ended up with fetal alcohol syndrome. Some of them were cocaine babies. And what it does, it impairs the early development of the brain, and it leads often to a plethora of other problems later on. And people might be wondering, like, what kind of problems does it lead to? Well, it leads to the difficulty in impulse control, difficulty in anger management, difficulty in making decisions, difficulty in solving problems. A good percentage of our clients suffer from schizophrenia, borderline personality disorders, and some even suffer from autism and degrees of mental retardation.
And I think the judge had mentioned something earlier, and this is a kind of a good concept. How do you show that someone actually does not know the difference between right and wrong? Well, as a defense attorney, I think that that's what you what your object is to show either they can or they cannot. And the judge makes the decision in this case of
or the jury.
Sure,
the trier of fact is the jury on that issue.
Right. So what? How do you go about doing that?
There are two ways to show someone has a mental impairment, whether it rises to the level of the McNaughton standard, which is the inability to distinguish right from wrong, which is rare, because most people with severe psychoses and neuroses can distinguish from right from wrong, but they just cannot control themselves to comply with the standard of refraining from wrongful doing, refraining from violence. But that being said, we establish this by showing based upon the events and the actions of the person, that this person was laboring, obviously, under some kind of mental defect. You know, normal people wouldn't have done what he had done, what the defendant did in a particular instance. He wouldn't have done the things he did throughout his life.
Right. So how do you show at the time of the offense that this, because that's kind of what we look at, and that's I know that's a difficult concept to do, and I don't mean to put you on the spot like that. It's an extremely difficult concept for people to understand that, you know, we look in psychology when we do these what we call risk assessments. We assess people for, you know, are they going to commit this violent act again or what is the percentage, you know, and there's almost a burden on us, especially on, you know, Your Honor, you're making the decision about this. And I know you have to look at, what's the possibility that they can ever do something like this again? How severe would it be if they were violent again?
Well, you know, from my standpoint on the bench, I am concerned about that. The issue of public safety and trying to assess the risk of violence with this particular person. And we are not, you know, I have a robe that I wear in court, but I don't have a crystal ball. And therefore, I'm not clairvoyant, and that did not come with a robe. And so we have to look at the facts and circumstances, and public safety enters into the picture. It just does. And I have to be mindful of protecting the public while at the same time being fair and impartial to the defendant who is convicted of a violent crime as well. You know, and let me also say that with regard to the insanity defense, what I've seen is that juries typically don't accept it.
More, I agree.
More times than not, don't you think, Alan, that they reject it? And I think one thing that they're looking for is an established pattern of commitments, diagnoses of psychosis, and extreme psychosis, and coupled with, you know, a pattern and history of bizarre and weird behavior, including the circumstances that led up to the crime in question. And even then, it may or may not work.
It was difficult.
You know, and I presided over the case involving a young woman who, along with her boyfriend, did a home invasion and first-degree murder of a pastor in North Caddo Parish. And you know, the alcohol field syndrome was one of the defenses in terms of mitigation, not in terms of whether she did the crime or not, but in terms of the penalty phase. And, you know, the mother got on the witness stand and talked about all the alcohol and all the substances she took during the course of her pregnancy and now how sorry she is about it. And there was evidence that she had done that through school records, through dysfunction and inability to perform, and you know, even the physical profile of this young female defendant appeared to be consistent with what we had learned about that syndrome. But nevertheless, the jury didn't buy it, didn't accept it. And I think that part of the concern by a jury is you have a vicious, violent, random crime. And they're concerned about public safety. Now, they apply the law to the evidence, and they're going to make sure the DA proves the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But they don't want to take any chances. These are regular citizens. And they've been called upon, they're ordinary citizens, called upon to do something that's extraordinary in so much as to assess evidence and determine guilt or innocence. And in a first-degree murder case, if it's a guilty verdict, what are we going to do with them? Are we going to send them to life? The options would be life imprisonment without benefit of parole or the death penalty. So they're called upon to determine that. With regard to that issue, sometimes they're concerned about violence perpetrated on guards and other inmates in the Department of Corrections. They've told me this.
Now, speaking with wardens, and I'm sure you've spoken with a few of those, I don't know one warden that has not said that they cannot control a prisoner. I haven't heard one even make that claim. But while we're paused, I want to remind our audience that we're speaking with Louisiana Supreme Court Justice Scott Creighton and the District Defender Board Representative Alan Golden. I think I messed that up.
Let's write that down.
There's no board. No board. Just the District Defender Office.
You
just
can call us at 1-800-552-8502. And I believe we have a caller.
Yeah, well, actually, we have a few questions that have been texted in.
Ah.
The first question is, if Medicaid expansion happened in Louisiana, would it lead to improved mental health access and therefore decrease violence?
I'll take that one. Right now, we have a shortage of mental health facilities, and many of our clients, and we serve about 20,000 people a year at the Public Defender's Office, about 5,000 felony defendants, another 12,000 misdemeanor defendants, and another 3,000 to 4,000 juvenile and family defendants. And what I've noticed is that we have people who have severe mental health issues, and when they're released from their jail obligation or their probation, they don't have a facility that will take them to provide necessary mental health care. And that has been a huge problem with veterans. Thankfully, we're addressing that problem with veterans courts, and hopefully the VA is providing more assistance to them. Going back to the case that Judge Creighton was referring to, where this lady who was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome as a child, we didn't have a crystal ball, but in that case, we could have used a time machine. We'd have gone back to the time after she was born and given her the proper intervention, I believe she would have never become part of the criminal crime spree that she was on with another male.
Well, you know,
I agree with that.
That's
sure.
One of our factors as well in trying to examine risk is to look at problems in elementary school. And unfortunately, sometimes we see that after the act's done. And it's kind of hard to, like you said, have the crystal ball and proactively, I mean, we're not, what is that movie that they're arresting people?
Minority Report.
I mean, we're not in the business of doing that because we're taking away someone's rights.
But we need somehow to intervene on their behalf. Left untreated, these illnesses don't get better.
Mm-hmm.
Many times they get worse, and they cause secondary problems, kids to fail in school, drop out, and if history has shown us anything, almost 70 to 80% of our clients are dropouts.
Sure. And I believe we have another caller.
Well, we have another text, and actually it segues very nicely into what we've been discussing. What is the balance of privacy of mental health disease versus public protection? How do we balance rights of the individual and rights of the public?
Oh, we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
Because now we're talking about confidentiality,
HIPAA.
And how are we going to, you know, maintain that if, for example, we do background checks for weapons. You know, everybody wants to say, well, how did, you know, this man, and I've heard this question before too, the man in Lafayette, he has a history of mental health problems, or any other person, how can we sell him a gun? Well, if these people have not been arrested and incarcerated for a mental health problem, we're not going to have a record of that.
Yeah, there may be no paper trail.
There's no, you know, the background check, the police officers aren't going to have access to mental health records because that's protected information. I mean, we have rights.
Well, that's right. And in fact, we have a right of privacy in the Louisiana Constitution. That's how strong we in Louisiana feel about our right of privacy. And it's encompassed within certain provisions in the United States Constitution. And, of course, by federal law in the HIPAA rules and regulations. That's a good question. It is a balance. And if there is not an arrest, and if there's not some certain event that happens, you know, the records really are private. Now, there are exceptions to this doctor-patient privilege that we have in the law, mm-hmm. which includes, you know, the situation where the patient tells the doctor, whether it's a PhD psychologist or a medical doctor psychiatrist, I'm going to kill people. You know, in fact, for example, the Aurora, Colorado theater killer had said, and he may have blogged this, which is another sign, by the way, this social media business where they actually say things that are rants and raves, much like Hauser did in Lafayette. But he said, I want to kill people when my life is over. Well, that is certainly a cry for some intervention, I would suggest.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a complex, multifactorial question that is a little bit hard to answer because it is a balance. And we as citizens in this country and in the state of Louisiana with this Louisiana constitutional right to privacy enjoy our privacy. It is a right. Now, in terms of buying a gun, that's another matter. I will say up front, I'm a pro Second Amendment guy. But I do think that the laws that are in effect with respect to the purchase of handguns, and this may be getting a little bit off of our main course here, mm-hmm. but they need to be enforced carefully and strictly, in my view,
sure.
with a delay period and a screening and all of that. The right to bear arms is not absolute, just like the First Amendment right to free expression and public speech is not absolute either. The things you cannot
do. That's correct.
All entail some sort of responsibility.
That's correct.
Absolutely.
What about a concealed carry permit? Do they have to sign a release to allow access to medical records for that?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I don't know
of anything that allows mm-hmm. access to it's sealed medical records.
It's a guarded privacy right. And now a commitment, on the other hand, is a different matter. And anyway, good question for the one who sent a text. Send us another complicated question that we can ponder, please.
I'd like to add that in many instances, mental health problems are very obvious, and there's usually a relative or a concerned friend who is aware of it. And I believe it's incumbent on that relative or friend to urge the person to get help. A lot of these cases deal with unchecked anger that festers and builds over a period of long period of time. And it involves frustration, alienation, and at a certain time, the person reaches a boiling point and then strikes out against anyone in his path and himself. The difference between a homicide and a suicide is one is anger turned outward on others, and the other is anger turned inward on oneself. And so when you see a homicide-suicide situation, you're dealing with somebody who is in a high state of rage.
Well, that's right. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of family. Everybody has a family, for the most part, I think. You know, you have a mother and a father, and the father may be absent, the mother may be unavailable and or absent. But in most cases, you have a parent, involved somehow, some way, to some extent, or you have uncles and aunts, or you have grandmothers and grandfathers, and you have family members, and there has to be and needs to be some level of accountability and responsibility placed on family. And likewise, with regard to school teachers, you know, think about this: the teacher spends, you know, the better part of the day with a group of kids, 30 of them, 40 of them. And he or she can begin to to see serious behavioral problems, which need to be distinguished from just mischievous behavior.
And a lot of times we see that.
Well, that's right. And it may lead to suspensions, but there needs to be at some point, they need to be trained and alert to the more severe exhibits of behavior that is potentially dangerous. And they need to notify family members. They need to perhaps notify authorities, mm-hmm. perhaps law enforcement. But I think it's incumbent, and there's some duty, I think, to do something well, as opposed to nothing.
I totally agree.
And on behalf of teachers, I would say that sometimes that they are kind of handcuffed by the rules for which they abide.
To some great extent, restricted by the rules, and they also are overworked and underpaid.
Absolutely.
And some of them try to just simply get through the day and hope that you learn a little something there. And it's a lot to do. And I don't criticize teachers at all. I'm suggesting these signs show up. Again, these are signs that have with some of these killers, whether it's a mass shooter or a person who shoots one person, there are, if you look back at their lives, there have been signs and indications and information there that was misinterpreted or just completely missed.
I'd like to invite our listeners.
And sometimes they're ignored.
To join our conversation.
Yes.
If you have any questions, call 1-800-552-8502 to speak with our guest. So teachers, that's a large, big factor for us to predict violence, school misconduct. But I think y'all were both alluding to one of the largest protective factors to prevent violence is kind of inclusion in their community, a sense of involvement. It's actually a way that we treat mental health disorders is to bring people closer to their families
developing
support systems, because this is a way that we can prevent these kind of behaviors. One thing that's really clear is that these are the people who are going to see it first.
Correct.
And can bring it to someone's attention.
What if the family member sees the signs and the person just refuses to get help? What avenues do they have to ensure that the person receives that treatment?
Well, I'm not so sure this is in my lane of travel or not. I might defer to the.
You usually see them after all of it.
Well, that's exactly
the
right.
The involuntary commitment, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
You can call the police. Mm-hmm. That's one, and you can have them involuntarily committed. And of course, there's, different avenues and links and things, hurdles that you have to overcome.
Well, that's true. And the coroner's emergency commitment is good for some number of hours, usually no more than 72.
Mm-hmm.
And so often is the case that the family member, in speaking to the coroner and filling out the paperwork, the person that has the severe behavioral issues is picked up and temporarily committed for a number of hours and evaluated and ultimately gets out.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
Well,
and that's only a temporary Band-Aid, if you will.
Sure.
One of the biggest predictors of crime, including violent crime, and I'm not going to focus on the mass murderers because those are kind of rare, relatively speaking.
Sure.
But most of the ordinary crime, most of the muggings, the murders, are not mass murders, were committed by serial killers or by deranged people.
They're just assaults, right?
Right. They're assaults, and these are people who are striking out in anger, people who are committing a crime of theft or something, and it escalates into something further. A lot of them are domestic abuse crimes that
which ones happen more, the romantic or relationship assaults or things that are, I guess, more criminal in nature, just fights or what have you?
romantic assaults. If that's not an oxymoron, I don't know what is. But, you know, the relationship crimes, the fights between the spouses, the abuse by a parent to a child, that is extremely common. And unfortunately, most of it's not reported. Or when it is reported, and even when charges are brought, as in the case that I actually was involved with today, the complaining witness, that's our legal term for the alleged victim, ends up recanting her story because she doesn't want to lose her husband. And unfortunately, we can't break that cycle of violence. But that being said, if you go back to the original predictors or the recipe for violence that Judge Creighton mentioned before, having a nuclear family is probably the best way to ensure that the members of the family are healthy and well-adjusted individuals.
So having a good support system.
Yes, that's
having
vital.
Having some good examples.
Exactly. Illegitimacy, by definition, means that you're going to start out with no home. You're not going to have a nuclear family. It's going to be a one-parent home. And statistically, a child born out of wedlock has a much greater chance of one day becoming part of the criminal justice system, starting as a child. Add to that the lack of a male role model. The child doesn't learn good values, doesn't learn good conflict resolution, problem solving, and how to control his impulses and anger.
So this means that it's important for like these big brother programs, athletic coaches being
right.
a significant part of these people's lives, these young men, young people's lives, so that they can kind of help.
That role. Yeah. Right.
Sure.
Any kind of male mentoring is important.
There's no doubt about that. And the Alan mentioned the support system. You know, I was blessed with parents that made me do certain things. You know, go to school, make good grades, behave, all those things.
That's terrible.
Terrible.
Eat your vegetables.
Terrible. Eat my vegetables. all that stuff.
Terrible stuff.
You know, so much of what we see in the criminal justice system is that there is no nuclear family. It's that menu. It's that recipe that I talked about. But getting back to the violent acts between romantic partners, that does seem to be sort of a contradiction of terms, it seems to me, because I would think of, you know, romantic
nothing
is...
Nothing romantic about violence.
Nothing romantic about that at all. But, you know, so often what we see is this situation, you know, boyfriend batters girlfriend or husband batters wife. Sometimes the wife batters the husband. But
sometimes.
Yeah, but more often than not, by far, what I've seen is that the male does the battering. The woman calls the police. The police have a near zero tolerance. They pick they arrest the one they think that's committed the battery, usually, again, the man. You know, he's booked in. He makes bond because it's a misdemeanor, which is domestic abuse battery. There is a requirement for a hearing now within a certain period of time. But as we near the trial, the victim wants to drop charges. And the DA typically in Caddo Parish has had a fairly zero tolerance on this issue. It goes to trial. It's set for trial. It goes to trial. And you know the spouse or the girlfriend or the boyfriend says, I don't want charges pursued by the DA, and may even say it really didn't happen. I filed a false report, which is a misdemeanor offense. If the drop charges request doesn't work,
and that happened today.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And I'm sitting there and looking at the two. Thinking that someone is going to get killed, but what am I to do about it?
Well, this goes to what you consider the imminence of that risk of violence, the severity of that if it does happen again. All these are considerations for you, correct?
And well, the public safety issue comes into play, but I have to have, from where I sit, I have to have evidence.
Sure.
And from where Alan sits, the DA has got to present evidence in order for his client and evidence proven beyond a reasonable doubt for his client to be found guilty. And we cannot deviate from that system. That is actually a very good system, and it's been our system in America for forever. So
it ensures reliability.
It does. It does. We don't want to see innocent people go to jail. And so when you have this situation where a woman, or again, I'm using this example because it's predominant. It's usually a female battered by a male, and if she comes into court and says it didn't happen, and the man who is the defendant exercises his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and does not testify, what evidence do we have in a situation where this happened behind closed doors? In the house.
Sure.
And so I have zero evidence, perhaps an officer saying, well, I got there, and she said it did happen. And she says, well, you know, I was just kidding. It really didn't. So in terms of evidence, certainly I cannot be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that person has to be found not guilty by law. Now, if it's proven that he did it, he needs to be punished. And many times there are domestic abuse battery offenders that are convicted are going to go to jail. The penalty, even though it's a misdemeanor by law, is one where it's pretty severe misdemeanor range of penalties with some mandatory jail.
And I know, as far as I'm concerned in psychology as a treater, if I'm trying to treat someone with domestic abuse battery who's been, you know, time to time we do treat these individuals. I believe that that's one of the mandated sentences for someone who is actually sentenced for a crime like this. They need to have treatment. We try to look at and see what their history is. Do they have a history? Were they abused themselves when they were a child? Were they? What is their temperament like? Do they have an anger problem? Do they have a personality problem? Do they have an impulse control problem or something like
substance abuse, alcoholism?
Substances, are they involved in this? Which is another factor involved in trying to predict this, you know, this phenomenon of violence. But I would like to invite our callers to call in and join our conversation. The number is 1-800-552-8502. We're talking about the issue of violence and how can we prevent this? What can we do? I know, Judge, you've got some things that you're doing.
Somewhere around 8 years ago or so, I noticed that there were just an inordinate number of young people coming before me that had been charged with armed robbery, attempted aggravated rape or attempted murder or murder, and some of these were 15 and 16. And the law is that for a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old, they would normally be at juvenile court being dealt with within the bounds of the Children's Code. However, in the event of the allegation of a certain high-level felony, such as armed robbery or attempted murder or aggravated burglary, the DA can transfer the case, in effect, transfer the case to district court.
Try him as an adult.
And so there was one day in court about 8 or 9 years ago where I noticed this inordinate number of young people, ages 15 and 16, charged with some very severe crimes, some of which carry minimum mandatory terms of jail, you know, 10 years, 15 years, with regard to armed robbery with a firearm, by way of example. And I was just quite frankly bewildered by it. And so my thought was, well, somebody needs to do something. And then I thought, well, maybe I need to do something. And so I ultimately designed this PowerPoint program, Don't Let This Be You, where I talk about a number of things involving, a little quick civics review at the very beginning, just so that they understand this. And this is designed for high school kids. They understand how laws are made. They don't just come out of the sky. They're made by us, by the legislature, and we vote representatives to senators into the legislative body in Baton Rouge, and so we address the civics review for about 90 seconds or so, because I don't want to lose them, right?
Yeah,
90 seconds is enough. And when I say civics lesson is over, it's a sigh of relief every time. But I talk about the laws that come into play. For example, the law on principles whereby if one is involved in the commission of a crime, even the getaway driver or the lookout, he can be charged with the completed crime committed by his friend. For example, the friend goes in to arm rob a clerk at the convenience store. He stays out and watches for police or anybody and then drives the other person away. Well, they're both guilty of armed robbery. And if there's a gun involved, it's a minimum mandatory term of 15 years. So think about a 15-year-old facing a minimum of 15 years as long as he's been alive. And also constructive possession of illegal drugs, for example, cocaine. Four guys in a car, cocaine in the car. Police stop the car, search the car, and they arrest all four of them. Because ownership is not the issue. The issue is possession, constructive possession, in the case of in this situation, which is enough to get them charged and convicted of that crime. I also talk about impulsivity, because I've had so many cases where some guy's angered by some event that happens and he takes an assault rifle. I'm not sure where he gets it, but he finds one, loads it, does a drive-by shooting and kills whoever made him mad.
Sure.
And that's anger-driven. It's extremely impulsive, and I've had too many people commit homicides in Shreveport where a jury's convicted them, and I've sentenced them to Angola for life. There was a group of four not too long ago that were ages 17 in high school. All four of them committed drive-by shooting, killed two young people. Those two victims were 15 and 16, and they were convicted and all serving life imprisonment, which means they don't come back.
Oh, right.
It's over.
I've met some of these individuals that, you know, committed these crimes at 16. Now, you know, as psychologists, you hit on an important point about the impulsivity. You know, there's parts of your brain that aren't even formed yet to be able to control that ability to inhibit yourself, to stop yourself from doing things.
Well, the brain is developing at that age, I believe, and you can speak again more mm-hmm. with more clarity than I can on that. But we're talking about an undeveloped brain because of the age. We're talking about, you know, go back to the recipe. Mm-hmm. You know, in the example I just gave, these four guys they grew up in socioeconomically challenged environments, and violence was a part of everyday life.
Single family homes,
and really a very sad thing. You know, one thing that and this is part of my program too. John F. Kennedy was right on in 1962 when he said a child miseducated is a child lost, and what he was talking about was education and don't drop out and get through high school and be educated. But here's the thing: lost children grow up, and this program that I do is by choice. It's something that's turned into a labor of love for me. It is about 75 minutes, and it covers a smorgasbord of different legal points that is age appropriate to consider.
Okay.
And you know, I enjoy doing it, and I've gotten a lot of good response from it. But my thought is to educate young people a little bit about the legal system so that they can stay out of trouble.
So consequences.
It's all about consequences, and it's all about the power of choice.
Sure.
You know, and you know, as a young person, you can choose to not be part of that group sitting, you know, that gets in the car with the cocaine all over the place.
Yeah.
Or you know, when your friend says, "Take me to the Circle K because I'm gonna commit a burglary or an armed robbery,"
you say no.
You might say, "I don't think so, because I learned that I could be just as guilty as you, even though I don't go in." It's about, you know, 15 or 20 concepts like that I share with them. My thought is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and it's my way of helping to educate.
Okay.
An ounce of prevention definitely is worth a pound of cure. And I think the problem goes back, I think Judge Creighton was alluding to the fact that if the children do not have a strong male figure at home, they're going to look for family wherever they can get it.
That's a good point.
And many times that family is a gang.
Yep.
Well, by default, the family is a gang and on the street corner. And what do they have? Well, they have all kind of screwed up values, including slinging dope and gunfire and things of that nature.
You know, personally, when you get a group of kids together, they don't make the best decisions anyway. There's research that backs that up.
Well, and there's certain chemistry going on. Call it peer pressure or whatever the chemistry and interactive forces are, but it's something going on whereby some bad things can happen.
And Shelley, I think we have a call.
Yes, actually, we have David from Polk County. He would like to know about anger management. Do we feel like this helps? Do we feel like teaching anger management skills decreases violence or helps with violent behavior?
I think it does.
Yeah, it's been my experience that defendants who are many times forced to undergo anger management courses or training or therapy do a lot better, and their chance of reoffending is dramatically decreased. So, in a sense, the cases where a domestic abuse violence case is prosecuted and they become part of the system, everybody's well served.
Well, David asked a good question. There's no doubt about it. I agree totally with Alan that anger management has got to help. In fact, I have, as a judge, ordered so many people to engage in a certain number of hours of anger management, conflict resolution therapy, because I think it's important and I think it does work. You know, these guys, have no coping skills. They have no conflict resolution sense. And they're easily aroused and angry about who knows what,
Sure.
But angry. And,
yes.
And certainly such was the case with the guy in Lafayette some days ago, angry about so many things and just ready to, blast off. And I think that anger management, and good intervention in therapy is extremely worthy. Another example of this is one thing that we do here at Caddo Correctional Center in Shreveport, in the reentry division. These are people who are convicted and they're sentenced to short periods of time, relatively speaking, 1 year or 2 years. Of course, that'd be a long period of time for me, Alan, don't you think? But anyway,
2 days would be too long.
Two minutes would be too long. But in any event, one of the many things that we do at Caddo Correctional Center is a series of programs on counseling and anger management, because a lot of them are there because they mismanaged. There, among other things, they mismanage their life, of course, but that includes certainly includes their anger and their rage, and they've got to understand how to channel that energy, that negative energy, and turn it into some productive level of energy.
Right. So I guess I'd like to ask our guests to summarize their thoughts on the subject we're talking about tonight, violence.
I think it all starts at the home. If you have a good family, a strong father figure who can teach good values, conflict resolution skills, and how to deal with anger, which is an emotion every one of us has, I think the children will grow up to be well-adjusted adults. I'd like to also note that there was a study done about elephants in Africa, where to thin out the population in one of the regions, they started killing off some of the males. These were the male adults. Well, as it turned out, the adolescent elephants started forming gangs, if you will.
I've read this study.
Of marauding groups, and they would go on rampages.
Because they didn't have any examples.
Exactly.
From the adults. They didn't learn these appropriate behaviors. I mean, all behaviors modeled. We in psychology, the Bobo doll experiments where you've got these things going on. The kids see violence on television. They see all of this stuff and they kind of get, I guess, inoculated against violence and don't think it's that bad. But,
Well, part of this, though, also is that this individual carrying all this anger has been hurt
yes.
at some point in his life, maybe hurt multiple times in his life, and it culminates, and it amounts to this level of profound hurt. And his attitude is, I'm going to transfer this hurt to you.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
And watch me do it. And we're going to, I'm going to transfer it to you by way of force and action and this destructive energy that's built up inside of me. I'm going to basically go ballistic, and you're the target of it.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank our guest, Louisiana Supreme Court Justice Scott Creighton, and the District Public Defender, Alan Golden, for sitting down with us today and talking about this subject of violent behavior, talking about consequences, talking about how to prevent it, talking about what can we do to, as a community, to kind of help identify these things, identify violent behavior.
I would like to add one other point. In terms of church attendance, one of the largest areas.
Per capita
church attendance in the nation. We're fourth largest in the nation. At the same time, we have the largest crime rate, highest crime rate. I think our churches need to become more involved as well.
I think church is a good support system for young people, and I applaud that notion.
It's another community.
Correct.
Exactly.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or health care provider for all health concerns. Health Matters is part of Red River Radio's Community Connection series of outreach programs. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation in Health Matters. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Snell. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake Gamble Guest Care's Assisted Living Community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. The topic will be thyroid disorders. I'm Shelley Visconti, along with Dr. Todd Lebrano. Thank you for joining us this evening.